Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Friday, September the 15th, 1995. In the fireside room this afternoon, our speaker is Jill Whitman. Her topic, Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier. Let's join the conference already in progress.
Tell about Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens today, about their history, and a little bit perhaps about sort of what the future may hold. And I wanted to just get started by setting the stage just a little bit and realizing sort of where we sit globally in this whole picture and why, in fact, we have these two mountains that are here that are so dramatic and have had fairly recent histories that have impacted humans. When we think as geologists about our Earth, we think of a system of what we call plates or pieces of the surface of the Earth that are in movement relative to one another. This is a fairly recent theory, emerged in the mid-1960s, and it's one that geologists have really felt quite comfortable hanging their hat on since. A lot of the phenomena that we observe naturally around the world fit into this system. And basically, we have these plates that are moving around. Some places they're moving apart. We call those divergent plate boundaries. Other places they're coming together or converging, and so those are called convergent plate boundaries. And some places they're simply slipping past one another. This is just a map of the plates, gives you the impression of some of their relative sizes. Notice that one, like the North American plate, can include both continental and oceanic material as part of this single rigid unit that moves together. Of interest to us is the fact that we sit right here on the western part of North America. We're actually on the North American plate, but we have this little Juan de Fuca plate off to our west, and that is what is driving the geology that we see in this area. We live, in fact, on what's called a convergent plate boundary. We have three very different kinds of convergent plate boundaries. The model that fits us best here is one that looks like this, where we have a small oceanic plate with oceanic crust coming together with continental crust on the eastern side. Some of our other convergent plate boundaries can either be oceanic and oceanic crust. Japan is an example of that. We still have some of the same kinds of features. The volcanism that's associated with this melting, descending plate gives us the volcanoes we see on the surface. And the other type is the convergence between two pieces of continental crust, and there we don't have one plate which bends and subducts. We have two huge masses of material colliding with one another, producing a tremendous amount of uplift in between. Large mountain ranges and the Himalayas are our example of that kind of a setting. But to return just to this lower type of setting that we have, to put it into sort of more of a regional picture, if we look here just at Western North America, the small Juan de Fuca plate sits here. It's converging with the North American plate and subducting beneath it. And the melting of that plate as it goes down is what gives us the volcanoes that we see here up at the surface. Various other things explained in this picture as well. The San Andreas is an example of where two plates are simply sliding past one another. We don't get volcanism, but we get earthquakes. We get earthquakes wherever two plates move past one another. So we have earthquakes here just as much as they do at the San Andreas Fault. Well, what we're going to focus on is a discussion of the Cascade Mountain Range. This is just a map to give us sort of the setting of the different mountains that fall within the mountain range. Cascades reach all the way from the northern part of California, Mount Lassen being the southernmost of these cascades, all the way up to Mount Garibaldi. And basically what that tells us is that we have subduction of a plate along this stretch of North America, the melting of which is producing those volcanoes we see at the surface. The Cascade Mountain Range, as we know it today, is a fairly young range of tall volcanic peaks. They, however, sit on a much older range of what has sort of been referred to as the ancestral cascades. So there's been a subducting plate in this region for a long time. The episodes have produced large volcanic mountains which have become eroded, and on top of those have been built new ones. We refer to our western cascades as our older cascades, and then on top of that we've now built our new high cascades. This is just a picture of Mount Rainier that shows us that the pile that we think of, the volcanic pile that we think of as Mount Rainier, sits on top of material, which is very different. Geologists use different sorts of symbols to show different rocks, different ages of rocks, different types of rocks. And so we see that Mount Rainier sits on a mass of material. In fact, this material that we find down here is what would have been in the core of the ancient mountain range. And as it eroded, that core was exposed at the surface, and then on top of that was built the new range of volcanoes that we call the Cascades today. The Cascade Mountains as we know them today, those peaks are all less, are 2 million years old or less. It's very recent geologically. Down in the elementary school, they're studying the history of the Northwest, the Pacific Northwest, and they started with a timeline for the beginning of the Earth at about 5 billion years ago. So the students there, the kids are coming to grips with what it means on this very long time scale to put the arrival of humans in this area just at the very end. And 2 million years geologically is a very short amount of time. So that's what we see. I'll come back and I'll actually be referring to this diagram again. All of the historic eruptions that have occurred in the United States, in the lower 48 United States, have actually been in the Cascades. All of the ones that have been known and documented by humans. And what I thought I'd do is sort of break my discussion up into two parts once I find the slide changer. And start out by talking about Mount Rainier, and then move on to talking about Mount St. Helens. Now, I'm not sure I know how to turn this light off. Let me know if it becomes a problem for looking at the slides and the pictures. We'll see if we can figure it out. Do you know how to do it? It's up there. Okay, so let's see how it goes with that. So what we're talking about is this range of mountains that extends up this way that we call the Cascades. The two peaks we're going to be talking about are Mount Rainier, which if you look at this picture here, you can see is one of the bigger bumps, a tremendous amount of glaciation on it. We'll talk about that later. And then Mount St. Helens, which is a smaller bump than it used to be, but off here to the west of Mount Adams. Mount Rainier is truly a spectacular mountain. Any of you who've been in the area, either living in the area or traveled through the area, realize that on a clear day when you're over at the Puget Sound, it looks as if Mount Rainier rises all the way up from sea level. It's 14,410 feet high. It's only about 60 or 70 feet lower than Mount Whitney, which of course is the tallest peak that we have in the lower 48 states. The Indians, the Native Americans in the area called it Mount Tahoma, or Tahoma, which meant snow mountain. That word has obviously been modified as we now say Tacoma for that area. It was the fifth national park established in 1899. And you can actually see here, as we have a view that looks up past Paradise, some of the older buildings in that area from the national park, which is there. There's great competition, I think, in between the national parks as to which is the most visited national park. And there are a number of national parks which make that claim to fame. Mount Rainier makes that claim to fame. And it's easy when you realize that a trip to Paradise is something which can be very easily be done. From either Seattle or Tacoma, and sort of a day trip. The other park which makes that big claim to fame is the Smokies, which similarly is sort of a day trip from Washington, D.C. And so I'm not sure who's really right in that whole discussion. The ridge around Mount Rainier is about 6,000 feet, so what we see is a peak which rises another 8,000 feet above that. As I said, all of these peaks that we see are younger than 2 million years old. Mount Rainier is one of the older ones, believed to have begun its volcanic history about 2 million years ago. It's a type of volcano that we call a stratovolcano, strata being a term used geologically to refer to layers. And it's, as all volcanoes are, it's made up of layers of the material which has been erupted. The difference is that we have sort of two kinds of volcanoes, and their appearance and their structure is dictated by their chemistry of the rock which has erupted. And the volcanoes that we've all seen wonderful footage of in their eruptions tend to be those like Hawaii with very gentle eruptions. The chemistry of that rock is such that the material erupted as lava flows out very smoothly and very gently over the surface, producing a very nice, broadly shaped volcano, which geologists call a shield volcano, having a very gently convex surface. In contrast, a stratovolcano, such as the two that we'll talk about today, Mount Rainier and Mount St. Helens, are very steep-sided volcanoes, and that's because the material which is erupted when it does come out as lava is very thick and flows very, very slowly, and hence doesn't flow great distances, so it piles up much more around the vent from which it's erupted. The other aspect of the layering of a stratovolcano is that a tremendous amount of what geologists call pyroclastic material, or loose ejecta ash and pumice, comes out of this type of a volcano in its more explosive eruptive phases. And so the layering that we find is the alternation between layers of lava which have cooled and this looser material, the pyroclastic material, which is accumulated. So we have this interlayering of the types of material on this kind of a volcano. The history of Mount Rainier, however, has been greatly impacted by its glacial history, which I'll come back to in a little bit, but that has carved very dramatically and eroded very dramatically the material which has been deposited here. And that's somewhat different from some of the more southern cascades, which are not quite as tall nor in as high a latitude. Now, it's another view to look at Mount Rainier from the Sunrise side over on the east side here. Mount Rainier is actually a fairly old volcano as far as this type of volcano goes, and it's believed that Mount Rainier reached its maximum height about 75,000 years ago, probably about 2,000 feet taller than it is today. And as with Mount St. Helens, it went through a stage of building up and then it blew its top. That explosion, that series of explosive eruptions, is believed to have been about 6,600 years ago. And the summit was ultimately destroyed about 5,700 years ago, leaving a large crater, or actually the more official term is caldera, here at the surface, about 2 miles in diameter. From that eruption, a tremendous amount of ash was produced, and avalanches of material, melting of the ice, which was in the glaciers on the side, and hence a tremendous amount of mud flows. And this is a map which is actually showing us the risk of mud flows in sort of the areas of high risk in red down to the areas of lower risk in yellow around Mount Rainier, but it does show us the path of a mud flow about 5,700 years ago called the Osceola mud flow, which geologists can trace out in its deposition. Basically, these mud flows flowed down pre-existing valleys, depositing material. A dam has subsequently been built in this location to prevent, theoretically, mud flows from reaching further out in that area. Any of you who are at all familiar with the Puget Sound area know that these valleys, this is the Kent Valley and the Puyallup Valley and the Orting Valley here, are ones that are extremely fertile farmland, in part because of the type of material deposited there from those mud flows. The Osceola mud flow was believed to have been about a half a cubic mile in volume of material, and it covered an area slightly greater than about 100 square miles. Buried an Indian settlement reached down to some of the areas of present-day communities that we know. A number of other mud flows have been found in the geologic record, excavations here in Puyallup, which is the site of the Western Washington State Fairgrounds, recently when they were putting in new utilities lines, exposed a number of layers of mud flows which had come from Mount Rainier. I, as a geologist, probably very unwisely live extremely close to that site. It's a wonderful valley to live in, but if I were to think about it from wise land investments for the next few hundred years, that might not be where I should choose to live. Mount Rainier had its last eruptions of any size about 2,500 years ago, some lava flows, some ash which was erupted, and it rebuilt within this summit caldera a small cone or dome here again at the summit. Um, There have been no eruptions from Mount Rainier in the last 100 years. The summit still has evidence of heat there, with some fumaroles and some steam being emitted periodically. But geologists do not believe that Mount Rainier is one that's at particularly high risk of any future eruptions. The cycle that this type of volcano goes through, when they look at it, they think that Mount Rainier is on the waning side of that cycle, and so it will simply now diminish in size as it's further carved by the glaciers that are there. What I'd like to do now is actually go ahead and talk a little bit about some of the glaciers that are there and some of the features produced by them. But Mount Rainier is a volcano which geologists wish they knew a lot more about, and in the 1990s, geologists nationally decided to study certain volcanoes over the period of the decade to learn more about them, and Mount Rainier is one of these, which is being very carefully studied to monitor the earthquakes which have occurred here and will continue to occur, and to get a better image of the subsurface geology in hopes of learning more about the future for this volcano. To just spend a little bit of time talking about glaciers, I'm actually going to talk more about glaciers tomorrow, but glaciers have played a huge part in shaping Mount Rainier, and this is just a diagram that illustrates the features produced by glaciers. If we take and fill valleys with ice, that ice moves or flows, and when the ice melts, either because the region is warmer or because the glaciers retreat, we're left with certain types of features which are labeled on here. But most dramatically, we end up with valleys that have a very gentle U shape to them. And in between those valleys, we have very, very sharp ridges. And that is very classic glacial geology from mountain glaciers. Very different from the kind of geology we see from valleys that are carved by rivers only, such as the Grand Canyon. We have a very steeply sided V-shaped valley, which is produced in that case. Basically, glaciers are a system of moving ice. The ice accumulates, and under its weight and the pull of gravity, it actually flows down and carves through these valleys. Much of North America was covered by ice cover up until about 10,000 years ago, which had actually been in a series of glacial advances and retreats. And we can see that the region of the Midwest and East had extensive ice cover down to much lower latitudes. Here in this area, the Northwest, we had ice in the very high elevations up in the mountain ranges and the Cascades, and then we had some lobes of ice down in the lower areas. That's what carved out the Puget Sound lowland. But Mount Rainier had extensive ice cover at that time. Today, we still have extensive ice cover on Mount Rainier. Mount Rainier has a system of 26 glaciers on it. Let's see if I can manage to do this backwards. North is up in this picture. So we see a series of different glaciers, all of which, as they melt, flow off and form some of the rivers, which we're all familiar with, here being the Puyallup River, the two forks of the Puyallup River, which flowed east into the Tacomatide Flats area. The Carbon River flows northward and ultimately joins with this fork here, which makes up the Green River, which becomes the Duwamish in Seattle. We can see this river system flowing off, and then Nisqually flows out. This way here is Paradise, where we had looked up from the south at the mountain previously, and then over there is Sunrise, where we looked up at the mountain from the east. But the Nisqually River, which flows out this way, if I can find it. Don't see it right now. Why is that? There's no Nisqually glaciers. This is the Nisqually River, is what flows down into Olympia.
Is Puget Sound on there?
Puget Sound will be up and over here.
Okay.
This is a close-up sort of on the mountain itself. There's a bullet about 35 square miles of ice on the summit of Mount Rainier, and these glaciers are constantly moving features. Their size tends to change through time. The Nisqually Glacier, which comes down quite close to the Paradise area, there are pictures of it from the turn of the century where it was a substantially larger glacier. Changing climatic conditions, it's retreated back up the valley somewhat to a smaller size. just to show some of the glaciers that we see. This is actually a picture of the Nisqually Glacier taken from the Paradise side. Classic appearance to the surface of a glacier. We can almost imagine that this solid mass of ice is in movement, and as it moves down over the surface of the rock, the surface of the ice cracks, forming features that we call crevasses. The material that we see down here in the lower part of the slide is all the sedimentary material which has been carried with the ice, and then as the ice melts, these deposits are left down here at the toe of the glacier. This is a view of the Emmons Glacier, which is over on the Sunrise side. Again, the surface of ice and the cracking of the surface and ice showing us how much it's in motion. Here we can see a valley over on the Sunrise side with this very classic U shape to it, indicative of having been carved by glaciers which have now retreated back up the valley. Just another view of Mount Rainier from sort of the south. Every time we see it from a different angle, we see different of those glaciers that are there. One of the things that we notice as we look at this mountain is that it is not a smooth-sided peak. And as we look at Mount St. Helens and its history, we'll see that it has had, prior to its major eruption, a much smoother side. One of the reasons is that Mount Rainier is a much higher mountain and has been carved by all these glaciers, leaving us this very, very rugged terrain around it. Okay. Well, I want to move on and talk about Mount St. Helens. Are there any questions about Mount Rainier?
Yes, I have a question. The little peak on the right-hand side on the east seems to be, from a distance, of a different material because it has a different shape. Is that so?
Well, different material. Depends how very specific you want to get as a geologist. Certainly, you would find that the material which makes this up is different in terms of its age and perhaps its very detailed chemistry from some of the other material we see in the mountain. But in general, it's the same kind of material that makes up the entire mountain. Uh-huh. It just is slightly different in age, has become separated from the rest of the mountain in part due to erosion of the material in between by glaciers. And I think that's referred to as Little Tahoma.
When those people died this summer off this mountain, do you recall the incidents?
Yeah, there were two.
Time of the summer, but I don't know what happens when they die like that, especially if they're expert climbers. I think there were about three that died.
Four, two on two different weekends.
Did it snow at that time, or what?
I don't know all the details. I certainly know less than those who went up to check out the sites, but I do know sort of what I read in the newspaper, and we had a very peculiar summer in terms of sort of freezing and thawing patterns, and somehow the surface of the ice that they were climbing was not as stable and much slicker than they had thought were the conditions. Mm-hmm. And since the two accidents occurred so close to one another, obviously that region was one that was particularly unstable for climbing on the surface.
Because, I mean, I know of people that have climbed up here successfully.
Yeah. No, it was sort of a tough summer for the Park Service there. Okay, well, now we're going to move a little bit south then, down to, this cord wants to walk with my foot, down here to Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens is one that we obviously all have some familiarity with, since in 1980 it made its presence known in a very, very big way. It's a much younger volcano in the Cascade Range. It's almost all of the visible cone that we see today for Mount St. Helens has been built in the last 2,200 years. So only about a hundredth of the age of the Mount Rainier cone that we know as today. That means most of it has been, almost all of it has been built since the last ice age, and hence hasn't had anywhere near the carving by ice that Mount Rainier had experienced. Picture taken prior to 1980, looking sort of down the length of Spirit Lake at at Mount St. Helens showed a very symmetric cone, very steep-sided cone, the classic shape for a stratovolcano. Mount St. Helens was often referred to as the Mount Fujiyama of North America, again having that very classic shape the way Mount Fuji in Japan does. Studies by geologists looking at the various volcanoes in the Cascade Range had determined that Mount St. Helens was the youngest of all the Cascade volcanoes, and hence, over the last 5,000 years, had had the greatest amount of volcanic activity. As I said, this cone is only a little more than 2,000 years old, but the site of eruption here had had an eruptive history for about 4,500 years. A lot of eruptions then had occurred fairly recently, not many of which were actually witnessed by white settlers to the area, but the Native American legends for this volcano referred to it as the Fire Mountain, obviously indicating that it had had a fairly extensive eruptive history. Major eruptive phase in the early part of the 1800s, from about 1800 to 1857, building of the summit of the cone here, sort of a dome within that summit here, and the formation of what's known as goat rocks over on this side of the mountain here. Some lava flows, a lot of ash eruptions in that interval of time. In this century, there had just been some very minor steam eruptions, very little evidence of any hazard associated with this volcano. However, a paper published in 1978 by two geologists at the Geological Survey had said that this was the most active and most explosive eruption volcano in the last 4,500 years, more so than any other volcano in the conterminous United States. And they made the prediction, named it as the volcano most likely to erupt before the end of the century. They actually, in their paper, thought they meant within the next 100 years. Little did they realize that it would actually erupt before the end of the 20th century. So what I wanted to do today for sort of the rest of this time was talk about that eruption in particular, some of the parts of that eruption, some of the features produced by that eruption. In March of 1980, a series of small but very sharp earthquakes occurred associated geographically with Mount St. Helens. And these earthquakes continued throughout April and May of that year with some very small ash eruptions. This is actually a picture of one of the smaller eruptions from early that spring. One of the effects we see right away from those smaller eruptions is that the summit of what had once been a very white volcano because of all the snow cover became a very black or gray volcano as all of this ash accumulated on it. A couple of significant features were produced as a result of these small eruptions during the spring. One was that a crater formed at the summit of the mountain, and also a bulge developed on this northeastern side of the mountain. Crater occurred up there, and on this side of the mountain, the side swelled out to about a half a mile from its original surface. It was a bulge that was about a mile long and a half mile across, and it's believed by geologists to have been due to the movement of magma, the molten material, up beneath the volcano, putting pressure up on the surface rocks and causing them to swell out of shape. This bulge was very, very carefully monitored by geologists. We're looking across Spirit Lake here at the volcano, but ridges that are located off in this direction north of the volcano became points from which geologists set up monitoring stations, and using very careful instrumentation from a distance, they were actually able to monitor the change in size and dimensions of that bulge without having to go to the volcano itself each day. Obviously, the risk was considered to be high enough that they weren't particularly interested in spending extensive amounts of time on the volcano. On May 18th of 1980, was when the eruption occurred, and geologists certainly saw that area as being one of very high risk, but were unprepared for the timing and itself. And I think a lot of Concern has been voiced by the public since that time of why weren't we better able to say what was going to happen. Part of it is because we'd simply never witnessed an eruption of this type, never seen those kinds of events that led up to it, didn't really know what was going to happen next. The volcano had actually been fairly quiet for a few days, with no evidence of eruptions and very minimal seismic or earthquake activity. And so geologists thought that it must be in a lull period, not realizing that what we had was the quiet before the major eruption. I'm sure many of you remember a lot of what was in the news at that time. Obviously, as we look at this picture, there were a lot of homes around Spirit Lake. This entire area had been evacuated, considered a high-risk area. The owners of these properties wanted to get in and get their possessions out of these homes. And people had been allowed in on Saturday, May 17th, and there was another time scheduled on Sunday at either 10 or 11 a.m. for people to again drive in a convoy to their homes and get their possessions and leave. But at 8:32 a.m. on May 18th, the volcano began its major eruption. And what I'm going to do is just show you here some diagrams which illustrate sort of the phases of the eruption as they occurred, and then actually show you some photographs of the various stages. Basically, this upper diagram shows us the shape of the volcano prior to any of this activity of 1980, and that's outlined by this red line, which is here. It shows us the shape of the volcano as of the morning of May 18th, with this summit crater having formed and this bulge here on the northeastern flank. The eruption had three parts to it. The first event, which occurred, were actually sort of two parts, and at this point, geologists still aren't sure which caused which, but the first thing which anyone in the outside world was aware of was a major earthquake occurring at 8:32 a.m. And that occurred simultaneously with this entire northern slope of the mountain simply collapsing as the largest landslide in recorded history. So this whole surface of the volcano, which had been experiencing the pressure from the upward movement of magma, simply gave way and slid down here in a series of what they illustrate as blocks. So step one was this huge landslide of material. Step two was what we think of as the explosion of the mountain. Huge cloud of gas, ash, and very hot gas burst forth in a blast from the volcano. Basically, once this block slid down, all the magma which had built up in the chamber was then exposed, and all of the gases that were part of that magma simply burst out from the mountain. So step two was this huge blast, and I'm going to talk about all of these more in a moment. And then step three was that which most of us saw captured in the news, which was an ash eruption, a column of ash which erupted for about 12 hours after that. The other two parts happened so fast that all we have are sort of a few still photographs taken of those events. Now, a couple of other diagrams to illustrate the same kind of thing. Here's instead a block diagram that shows us what the mountain looked like prior to the eruption. North is in that way, so the north summit of the volcano is here. Spirit Lake, you saw some of the pictures, is here. And the Toutle River that we'll talk about more flowed westward from Spirit Lake out, ultimately joining with the Columbia. So this is showing us sort of phase two in the eruption. Phase one, the huge landslide has already occurred. You can see sort of this brown mass which has moved down. Phase two, this blast of material is coming out to the north. And then this shows us sort of after the fact what the volcano looked like, same orientation. This whole huge crater has been produced. The north side of the volcano has slid down and been blown off. All of this region has experienced what we call the blast, the large flows of material which came down off here to the north, much of which actually flowed out also to the west. So what I'm going to do now is actually show some pictures that illustrate some of these things. This is a photograph that was taken from the air on the morning of May 18th, right about 8:32, as two geologists had hired a private pilot to take them up around the volcano. You know, the volcano had been showing all sorts of interesting signs of activity, and they wanted to go up and get their pictures of it. They had no inkling of this major eruption taking place. They had just circled the volcano, taking the pictures out of the west side of their airplane. This picture is basically just as this block of material has slid down and the very first burst of the blast is coming out. Obviously, they got out of there in a very big hurry. So that's the north side that we're looking at. Next couple pictures are taken from a site called Bear Meadow, where there was a campground outside the limits of the area that were closed off. A guy had gotten up in the morning, set up his camera on a tripod, and had it all poised and ready to take a series of photographs of the volcano. He was standing there when this blast took place, and he just pushed his shutter as fast as he could as he saw this event taking place. You know, had he had his back turned or whatever, he wouldn't have had this series of photographs. He made a lot of money, however, out of selling these photographs.
He almost also lost his life.
Yeah, there were a couple of other geologists who were much closer in who did, in fact, lose their lives. He was not a geologist. He was simply a camper. He was actually outside the area of the damage from the blast and was quite lucky. But as we sort of see pictures of the increasing size of the blast.
Can you take a picture of that? Is it legal for me?
You can try. You can if you'd like to.
I don't know.
I have no idea how it'll come out.
Some things aren't legal to do, but I can.
Well, it isn't legal, but if you don't tell anyone, it's all right.
I just want to show my grandkids.
These are actually pictures that one can purchase.
Can you back up to that very first one?
First one?
Yeah, where the pilots or the geologists.
You can see here
that may blank it all off.
Yeah, don't know.
Your flash may blank it all off.
It might, on the other hand, it might be okay.
Oh,
you mean
something to the film?
No.
It doesn't. The surface is reflective surface.
Yeah.
So that we can see this picture. Yeah. But when you flash, you may not get anything on that at all.
You'll have to see. This is a funny surface, and it may have given you. You can see in this picture that the ash cover and the snow showing through beneath it. So, his sequence, one of his first that he caught, one of the subsequent ones, and then sort of as that cloud got very close by. No.
Over the world.
No, that was the next phase of the eruption. This was simply a very instantaneous part of the eruption. So this is sort of what was witnessed from fairly close by on the ground. And now I have some pictures that will show you sort of some of what we see today as remnants of the various parts of the volcano. This is a picture taken from the northeast as we look at the volcano today. The crater of the volcano is sort of in there. North is that way. And what we can see here is all this massive material. This very bumpy terrain are the blocks of material that simply slid down in that first phase of landslide from the volcano. And what I have here is a picture, and then the next picture sort of takes off and goes off in that direction further as we look then the summit over here. And all of this material was a huge mass of material that slid down into the valley. When one gets close up to it, it looks like moonscape. Nothing grows on it. It's just this very irregular terrain. Big blocks of material that simply slid down. This is a map view, which looks down at the mountain. Here we can see this north side of the crater. The blast came out in this direction. And the brown outline that we see here is the outline of the region in which the blast impacted the land underneath it. The movement of the gases in that blast are believed to have been as high as 730 miles per hour, reaching out to distances of almost 20 miles from the summit itself. Temperatures up in the hundreds of degrees. And the next few pictures that we'll see show this devastation. trees that were just completely flattened by this very, very fast, hot moving gas. The trunks themselves were still there, flattened, but all of the living vegetation was simply seared off of these trees, able to simply break them off at their stump. You can see flat-lying trees up on the hillsides behind. Other views. The edge of the blast zone was very abrupt, and what we can see here is flattened trees, a few standing trees that are completely charred, and then right beyond it, the green of the living trees beyond. Not unlike forest fire, in that we can see those abrupt edges. However, the difference here is that all of these trees are just completely flattened. Here we're out almost to the edge of the blast zone, so we still have a few remaining standing ones. This is a view taken as one approaches from the northeast. Basically, Bear Meadow is behind us a few miles, and we're right at the edge of the blast zone. A few trees that were left standing, although the vegetation was completely charred off of them, looking beyond at the area that's completely flattened. Has anybody ever been into this area of Windy Ridge at Mount St. Helens? It's a really spectacular drive. You drive in from the northeast corner, you drive through very heavily forested land, it's national forest land, and all of a sudden, right here, you emerge into the blast zone. And every person I've ever gone in there with is the same reaction, just this gasp, because it's so abrupt. And what happened following the eruption in 1980 was a series of land trades between nationally owned forest land and privately owned land, in particular Weyerhaeuser Corporation owned land, to try and establish a national monument. And Mount St. Helens is not a national park, it's a national monument established in 1980. And what they've done by these land trades is to establish a single block of land surrounding the mountain, which is owned by the National Park Service and maintained as a national monument. It had not been so simple, as all this was national forest land and beyond it was private land, but by these series of trades, they were able to establish this huge area of land, which the National Forest, the National Park Service will maintain as, other than the visitor centers and roads that are put in, a completely untouched area following the eruption. Will be allowed to regrow completely naturally, no intervention. One drives in a road which kind of wanders its way up to a ridge with a very good overlook point up here, and all of the land to the west is then National Monument land. All the land to the east, on your left side as you drive in this road, is owned by Weyerhaeuser. They went in and cleared the timber, the fallen timber. You know, it was already kiln dried. It was perfect wood to sell and use. And they've gone in and replanted in that area. And you can see very regular rows and arrangements of very small seedlings that have gone in the last decade or so. And it presents a very interesting contrast as one drives in on these roads to look at the untouched area with the natural regrowth and the area which has been managed for its regrowth. And as the years go by, it will be very interesting to be able to see that. This is a view looking across Spirit Lake to the crater. You can actually look right into the crater here. This is north coming out in this direction. This is all Spirit Lake. Spirit Lake comes down, its shores are sort of on the other side of this ridge, and floating on Spirit Lake is this mass of downed timber from the eruption. Still floating. The cooking that it experienced was such that it basically doesn't get soggy from the water and sink to the bottom. And there's this log mat which has been floating on the surface of Spirit Lake for the last 15 years. Every time you go, it's in a slightly different location, moved by the air circulation, the winds down in that area. Windy Ridge, basically, you come down to right here to a vantage point to look. You can look down to Spirit Lake and over toward the summit itself. This is a view from the air. North is off in sort of that direction. Here's the summit of the volcano and the crater opening out. This is Spirit Lake right here. This is Coldwater Lake. New visitor center opened about 3 years ago here at Coldwater Lake. Has an okay view, this sort of a low ridge in between. Not as good a view as I would like. And they're opening in 96. I think it's out here on this ridge, another visitor center, which will look straight into the crater and have a spectacular view. But what we see here is the area impacted by the blast. The edges of this blast area, and then the very white superimposed on it are the mud flows, which I'm actually going to talk about in just a minute. But all of that area dramatically impacted by that eruption. The little specks of light-colored areas surrounding it, who knows what those are? Those are clear cuts. Yeah, those are clear cut timber areas.
Could you show where Windy Ridge, where is that?
Well, Windy Ridge is sort of down.
Oh, that close? I see.
Yeah, it's quite close. I think it's somewhere between 3 and 5 miles from the summit, so it gets quite close in.
Uh-huh. When you say that there's going to be a visitor center, does that mean you can drive up
Yes,
there,
you can drive to the one at Coldwater Lake right now, which is located sort of looking down over the lake. Mm-hmm. And then the new visitor center, which will come in, on the road that kind of snakes up to it, and that you
are
can
those
drive to.
New roads?
Yes. Highway 504 came in along the Toodle River all the way up to Spirit Lake, and that's how people accessed it at that time. Highway 504 was completely taken out by all of these mud flows that went down the river valley, and they've had to rebuild progressively those bridges. And that's why the visitor centers have been as long an opening as they have. There's another visitor center out at the end of Highway 504 where it intersects Interstate 5. It's a very small visitor center, been there since about 1982. It has wonderful displays, but you can't really see the mountain from it. It's great to stop at, but you have to stop for the exhibits and not for the mountain itself. The drive that comes into Windy Ridge basically comes in from this direction, driving through forested land, and then makes its way in through the blast area. It's very dramatic because you go from forested land into the blast area. When you come up Highway 504, it's very hard to know when you enter the blast area. Partly you're driving up area which was highly impacted by the mud flows, but you're also driving through areas which have had a lot of clearing of timber already. And so the drama isn't as great. There is a wonderful story of shortly after the eruption, then President Carter came out to observe this disaster area. And they were flying over, and he looked out the window of an airplane and said, that's awful. Look at that devastation. And they said, Mr. President, that's a clear cut we're looking at. There's a lot of clear cut in that area. Okay. So then following the blast was this eruption of ash, which continued, as I said, for about 12 hours. The column of ash was about 12 miles high. And the material produced from this was what was then carried by the prevailing wind directions eastward over the state of Washington, ultimately over North America. And that, I think, is what you were talking about, sort of the impact falling out from that. I'm not quite sure if this is where I have my blank. I'm going to come back and show where some of that ash traveled in just a moment. But this is the map that shows us where material from this eruption was carried. The avalanche of the material, the big landslide that came down off the side of the mountain, came and flowed down through this river valley, giving us what we sort of call this debris avalanche. But following that, with all of the eruption of ash and the hot gases coming out with the ash, there was a tremendous amount of melting then of all the snow that was on the summit of the volcano. And that resulted in a tremendous amount of mud flows. All the loose material that was coming out in the form of ash, the looser rocks that made up the summit of the mountain, and all of that water that melted from the snow produced these mud flows. And we can see that they went off in a number of different directions. Off to the north, to the south and to the east, off directly to the west, and a tremendous amount coming down to the Toodle River, sort of a couple forks of the Toodle River, coming out here into the Cowlitz River, and ultimately coming out here into the Columbia River, actually blocking navigation in the Columbia River. If you drive down Interstate 5, you actually come down Interstate 5 parallel to the Cowlitz River for a while until it parallels the Columbia. And the first time I ever drove along that stretch, I said, what are those huge piles of stuff there next to the highway? not much growing on it, big piles of sediments and stuff. And it's everything that was dredged out of the Cowlitz in order to make it navigable again.
It kind of looks like gray tailings.
It does look like gray tailings. And yet, you know, there's sort of no surface activity around it to give any evidence of its source. I mean, there isn't a gravel pit or anything like that. And I mean, at first I really had no inkling of what it was. Just some views of some of these mudflows. This is a view from the west looking up the Toodle River Valley, and you can see sort of all this gray here is simply material, muddy material that came off the summit of the volcano. The summit's up in here in this cloud. It was a very cloudy day that day. And just a view further on down, actually, the Toodle River, toward its mouth at the Cowlitz, again seeing how much of this river valley is just filled with sediments from that eruption still today. A view off to the southeast, seeing some of the evidence of the mudflows that came off the backside. I mean, the crater is open facing away from us, but mudflows still came off in this area as well. This is a diagram that shows us how much the mountain changed in its shape. Its original height was 9,677 feet high. It lost, its present elevation is 8,364, having lost about 1,300 feet in elevation. About 10 million trees were destroyed in this eruption. 57 people died, most of whom were within the area illegally that had been closed off. Some of whom were outside the closed off area. The prediction simply had not given any inkling of how large an area would be destroyed by that. One of whom was a geologist who was at a monitoring site, knew the risk he was taking. His name was Dave Johnston, and it is at Johnston Ridge, where he was located, that the new visitor center will open next summer. A crater a mile in diameter was produced by this blast, all of the material blown off. About a third of a cubic mile of material is believed to have erupted from the volcano. If I've got this right, I've got space for my overheads. These are some diagrams which aren't very elegant in color, but give us a little sense of some of the amount of material erupted. This is just a map giving us a location. This is a map very similar to what we saw before. The limits of the blast, the downed trees, the mud flows and debris flows, and this shows us the approximate area that the ash cloud traveled across North America. At least 2 inches of ash fell in this area here, continued over the next 2 days, reached all the way to Washington, D.C. Impacted sunsets all over the country for about a year or so, or all over the world for about a year or so. The third of cubic mile of material which was produced from this blast is shown in its relative proportions to some of the other historic and geologic eruptions which have taken place. Mount St. Helens down here, this is all done in kilometers, but a block of material that size was produced. The eruption which produced Crater Lake, blowing off the summit of that volcano, is represented by this block, about 30 times as great. And if any of you have been to Yellowstone and read anything about the geologic history there, Yellowstone basically sits within an enormous, what we call caldera, huge blast of material blown out of there. And basically, these last three blocks represent the volumes of material from those eruptions, in contrast to Mount St. Helens. It sort of puts it into proportion for us. We think of the Mount St. Helens eruption as having been so dramatic, and yet, geologically, there have been events of much, much greater magnitude that we just simply haven't witnessed.
When were those other significant eruptions you mentioned?
Well, this is giving it, as geologists express it, in time. And what this abbreviation here means is million years before the present.
Okay.
So 1.2 and 0.6 and 2.2 million years ago. The Mount Mazama was just less than about 7,000 million years ago. Another major eruption that a lot of people may have read about was Krakatoa, which is down in the Indonesian region there. Tremendous number of deaths because it was a volcanic island that exploded. Huge volume of water rushed into the crater and rushed out again in what we call a tsunami, just devastated the surrounding islands. This is a view, this is Mount St. Helens that we see here on the right, a view of a subsequent eruption in June, and another subsequent eruption in July. Eruptions continued throughout that year, much smaller scale ash eruptions, and dome build, whoops, I wonder where those ended up, some dome building eruptions as well. These are just some pictures to show the regrowth of vegetation, which is taking place naturally. This is fireweed. As its name implies, it grows in areas that have been destroyed previously. What we see here is in a pocket down in a valley that was somewhat protected in the blast. You can see there's some sort of taller snags still standing. Some of the first pockets of vegetation reappeared. It's another view as well. This dome building process took place basically between 1980 and about 1986, building up a small dome of a very thick or viscous lava, just sort of gradually increasing inside within the cone. Close-up view of it, obviously a lot of steam produced as well. And what we have today is a view that looks something like this. Periodic steam emissions, no dome building evidence since 1980, since about 1986, and the volcano doesn't show much seismic activity, so geologists don't think of it as a current threat for eruption. It's believed that it would take centuries to regain that lost height through this very slow progressive rebuilding of that dome within the crater. Before I end, I just want to tell one little anecdote that I've heard. How many of you know the Tacoma Dome? Anybody know the Tacoma Dome? Structure that's basically an indoor arena that exists in Tacoma. One of my colleagues heard the rumor that the Tacoma Dome, which is the largest wooden structure in the Northern Hemisphere, is built entirely of lumber from the blowdown of Mount St. Helens. The timing of building it is actually quite right. He tried to call around to the city and to people to find out if that was in fact true. And he never was able to get a completely affirmative answer. Somebody in the city said, oh yeah, sure, but it was sort of puzzling. You would think that they would advertise it more about the Tacoma Dome, that it had sort of this unique history to it. But as you drive by the Tacoma Dome, if you ever get the chance on Interstate 5, just think of
that. Well, would Weyerhaeuser have, I mean, would that have been some of their lumber that they...
Quite possibly. Yeah. That's right.
But the dome part, isn't that material?
No. Well, it has an asphalt covering like any structure would. But
can that open up at all?
No. But unlike the King Dome, which is concrete, reinforced concrete structure, Tacoma Dome is wood.
Okay. Because we have one at the University of Northern Iowa.
And it opens?
No, it doesn't open, but it's a material. Mm-hmm. And when too many people go through the doors at one time, it causes some kind of a... And then last winter when it snowed, they have to get the snow off of there because it collapsed. And they couldn't use it for a while.
It's sort of like an inflated structure,
it's a very unique situation. Oh, boy.
It was one of those at Harvard University. Uh-huh. Back in the winter when I was a child growing up, we had heavy, heavy snows and it collapsed.
It looks like the same material. It's wood, rigid wood structure. I've gone over time, but I know people may need to move on to other things, but if anybody has any questions, I'll endeavor to answer them. Very interesting.
I seem to remember there were some problems with Spirit Lake. There was something about they had to dig channels or drain it.
Spirit Lake. It's more than just Spirit Lake, but Spirit Lake has no natural outflow following the eruption. The landslide came down and blocked off what had been the natural outflow. And while they don't want to interfere with nature within this National Monument area, they wanted to prevent too much of this loose material continuing to wash out into the river system. And so what they've done is, if you go to this area, I don't have a picture of it, but on the ridge that's sort of right here on Spirit Lake, you can actually see where they drilled a tunnel through the ridge to drain...